Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's episode, we'll feature a debate. The topic, is Barack Obama a progressive, was debated by longtime activist scholars John K. Wilson and Paul Street. We'll hear presentations by both scholars as the feature presentation of today's show. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This has been a summer of intense heat, violent storms, and AstroTurf. AstroTurf is DC slang for the phony grassroots organizations bought and paid for by various industry groups that have been sprouting up like mushrooms after the rain. AstroTurf spokesmen like Dick Armey of FreedomWorks and Tim Phillips of Americans for Prosperity rent themselves out to corporations, publishing op-eds, running ads, and showing up at events pretending to be angry citizens. Lately, they've been very active on a number of legislative fronts, spreading misinformation about the energy bill, health care reform, and financial regulation. Now the AstroTurf groups are turning their attention to net neutrality, the longstanding principle that keeps the open internet free from corporate gatekeepers. Tim Carr of Free Press.
We're seeing AstroTurf groups attack net neutrality. Coincidentally, new legislation in favor of net neutrality, the Internet Freedom Preservation Act of 2009, was introduced in the beginning of August. So the AstroTurf has become very active, and we released an interactive online tool that exposes the fake grassroots at freepress.net/AstroTurf, where people can go and actually reveal the money behind these phony front groups.
There's a common theme across AstroTurf efforts this summer. Any new form of public policy or attempts to regulate industry in any way is called out as socialist or communist.
This sort of red baiting, you know, we haven't seen since the era of the Soviet Union and the Cold War. It seems to have reemerged in 2009 as the new face of AstroTurf.
How can this kind of fake public interest group be stopped? Carr says you have to expose them at every turn.
Call them out for presenting themselves as independent analysts on any given policy issue without fully disclosing the money that punches their tickets, which is a common practice. They very rarely, if ever, disclose that they're being funded by industry. And you also need to call out the media. It's just, you know, laziness on the part of the media. The media repeatedly refuses to cite the money behind these spokespeople.
Carr says that it's important whenever there's a spokesperson for one of these groups on a website or TV to provide feedback to the media.
I commonly go into the comment threads of stories on the internet, and I point out to the journalist who reported the story and to the readers that that person is actually funded by industry.
For more information about AstroTurf, go to freepress.net/AstroTurf.
The month of August is typically quiet in Washington, D.C., but statistics have been pouring in that are making some noise. They illustrate the impact of government policy decisions on communities across America. This week, Media Minutes takes a look at a couple of examples. Speed is everything. Reports from the Communication Workers of America, Wired Magazine, PC World, and other companies have begun to shed light on the broadband industry's best-kept secret, that they can rarely deliver the speeds advertised. While fully verified testing has not been performed in the United States, others overseas have shown Americans have good cause for concern. According to a report released earlier this month by Ofcom, the United Kingdom's telecommunications regulatory agency, consumers were receiving broadband speeds that were 45 to 56% slower than advertised. And the Organization for Economic and Community Development reports there is a great disparity in many countries between the speeds advertised by internet service providers and the speeds actually available to the consumer. Cable prices continue to climb in Michigan. The Detroit Free Press reports that 3 years after Michigan passed major changes to its local cable TV regulations, which stripped franchising authority away from local municipalities and towns and gave it to the state, none of the promises of the bill have been delivered. Prices are still high and continue to rise. Entire communities have been left off the grid, and customer service has not improved. A survey funded by local governments found that basic cable TV rates rose from 9% to as much as 50% in 2008. And there has been essentially no increase in competition. Most communities have only one option available to them for cable TV service. And both Comcast and AT&T have poured substantial funds into campaign contributions for state politicians, surpassing even the donations of the Michigan-based Big Three auto companies.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact.
Despite high-speed internet making up 25% of a cable company's revenues, they devote no more than 3% of their cable lines to delivering broadband. That's according to Adam Lin, policy coordinator of Free Press. Meanwhile, Lin explains, it is estimated that a cable company's typical profit margin for broadband service is 80%.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a presentation. Amidst policies from the Obama administration that might be construed as a mixed bag from a progressive political perspective, the question can be asked, is Barack Obama a progressive? Two scholars and activists approach the question and respond with different answers. Paul Street is an independent radical democratic policy researcher, journalist, historian, and speaker based in Iowa City, Iowa, and Chicago, Illinois. He is the author of four books, including Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. John K. Wilson is a scholar and activist, founder of the Institute for College Freedom, and author of five books, including President Barack Obama, A More Perfect Union. The following presentations took place at a panel organized by the Open University of the Left and held at the Lincoln Park branch of the Chicago Public Library on Thursday, August 27, 2009. We'll first hear from Paul Street.
Thank you, Open University. I didn't really write a book about Obama. I wrote a book about the United States corporate and empire captive media saturated dollar democracy in what I knew by late 2006 to be the dawning age of Barack Obama. Is Obama a progressive? John says yes, I say no. But I wonder how much the question actually matters at the end of the day. Obama wasn't selected to head the local United Way, or his and my favorite baseball team, the Chicago White Sox. He's chief executive of the American Empire. He is a politician above all, one who was selected to sit atop and to, I think, rebrand what the left liberal political scientist Sheldon Wolin rightly calls Democracy Incorporated. Every 4 years, millions of Americans are induced put their political hats on, to hope for a while and then to go back to sleep, to hope that a savior or at least a more effective manager can be installed in the White House to raise wages, roll back militarism, provide universal health care, rebuild infrastructure, fix the environment, reduce inequality, and make life generally more livable for human beings. The savior can be named Jack or Bobby or Teddy or Gene or George or Jimmy or Bill or Hillary or John or Adley or Barack. It doesn't necessarily matter under the rules of what Wolin calls corporate managed democracy. Officially electable candidates who want a serious shot at lasting power subordinate themselves to what Ed Herman and David Peterson call the unelected dictatorship of money, which, quote, vets the nominees of both parties, reducing the options available to U.S. citizens to just two candidates, neither of whom can change the foreign or domestic priorities fundamentally. Regime. The Obama White House so far, I think, is a fairly chilling object lesson in the reach, power, and bipartisan nature of that unelected dictatorship. Obama is following what David Rothkopf, a former Clinton official, calls the violin model. You hold power with the left hand and you play the music with the right. In other words, you gain and hold the presidency with populist pleasing, progressive sounding rhetoric, but you govern. You make policy in standard service to existing dominant institutions. So, You lecture Wall Street on the immorality of their bonuses. You visit Elkhart, Indiana to show solidarity with downtrodden working people. And then you give yet more of the public treasury and commons away to the privileged few, justifying the handouts as a noble expression of your, quote, sensible, quote, realistic, and, quote, pragmatic commitment to rising above ideological divisions to, quote, get things done for the American people. Funny how our pragmatist in chief keeps getting things done, especially for the rich and the powerful. The mind and the soul go numb as yet one more populist, progressive, and peaceful-sounding campaign promise gets drowned in the icy waters of corporate and military rule. It must have been a sort of strange time for many of Obama's progressive fans, what with their peace president's blatant escalation of civilian slaughtering war in South Asia, indefinite continuation of the Iraq occupation, increase of the Pentagon budget, advanced dismissal of a peace dividend, advanced approval for an Israel attack on Iran, refusal to move in any serious way against Israel's occupation of Palestine, apparent commitment to building a provocative missile shield in Eastern Europe, embrace of NATO expansion, ambivalent, tepid response to the right-wing coup in Honduras, embrace of the war on drugs in Colombia and Mexico, and continuation of numerous key aspects of George W. Bush's counterterrorism program. Obama, Jeremy Scahill notes, is a brilliant supporter of empire who has figured out a way to trick people into believing they're supporting radical change. Scahill even says the president is an Orwellian character. He can make people think that war is peace. Then there's Obama's domestic agenda for and by the wealthy few. In the May 2009 Atlantic, Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, not an economist with Z Magazine or Monthly Review or something, argued that Obama is in Wall Street's pocket. In an article titled "The Quiet Coup," Johnson noted that the Obama administration, like Bush, has taken extreme care not to upset the interests of the financial institutions or to question basic outlines of the system that got us into a great recession. Quote, the elite business interests who played a central role in creating the crisis with the implicit backing of the government, using their influence to prevent precisely the reforms that are needed exactly as in a third world emerging market nation, Simon Johnson said. Obama, Noam Chomsky notes, made sure to staff his economic team with advisors from the financial sector. Goldman and Citi alumni, but by and large, Robert Rubin, Timothy Geithner, and so on and so forth. You know all about it. This helps explain Obama's willingness to expand the Bush policy of transferring trillions. My mind glazes over as I try and keep track of the dollar number. Two, financial parasites and perpetrators, and also helps explain Obama's unwillingness to displease the financial lobby with clearly indicated progressive measures, like seriously restricting executive compensation, like reinstituting the Glass-Steagall separation of commercial and investment banking, unwilling to close regulatory exemptions on customized derivatives, or to ban the notorious credit default swap, or to break up, of course, the too big, and I always say, and too powerful to fail banking firms. As bailouts for oligarchs combined with growing destitution among the populace last March, liberal left journalist William Greider put it well. He said, people everywhere have learned a blunt lesson about power. They have watched Washington run to rescue the very financial interests that caused the catastrophe, and they've learned that government has plenty of money to spend when the right people want it, but nothing or very little for the lower and working class majority, even with Democrats in power. As official unemployment moves towards 10%, and actual unemployment is closer to the mid-teens. It is revealing that Obama's economic stimulus contained no reference to the urgently needed labor law reform he campaigned on, the Employee Free Choice Act, whose critical provisions have already been kicked to Washington's curb under business pressure, zero protest from the president. Then there's Obama's health reform for and by the nation's leading insurance and drug companies, and popular private-public mishmash, all too consistent with the hundreds of millions of dollars Obama and other leading Blue Dog, Blue Cross, Blue Shield Democrats, like strategically placed Max Baucus, have received from the health sector finance and insurance industries in the last few years. It's not for nothing that Obama's presidential campaign garnered a record-setting $39 million from fire, finance, insurance, and real estate industries, $10 million better than McCain, $44 million from the legal and lobbyist sector, $33 million better than McCain, $25 million from communications and electronics, $20 million better than McCain, and more than $19 million from the health sector, $12 million better than McCain. You don't have to be a Marxist to be concerned about Obama's service to economic loyalty. Two Sundays ago, liberal New York Times columnist Frank Rich, something of an Obama fan last year, wrote an editorial noting the absurdity of Republican claims that Obama is a socialist and saying that the real fear is that Obama might be just another corporatist, punking voters, much as the Republicans do when they claim to be for the common guy. And I said, might be? Obama is advancing what the liberal novelist and political writer Kevin Baker calls a business liberalism that, quote, espouses a pragmatism that is not really pragmatism at all, just surrender to the usual corporate interest. The left liberal senior black congressman, single-payer advocate John Conyers, recently described Obama's health care plan, and I quote, as crap, adding that nobody is more disappointed in Barack Obama than I am. And that's not John Pilger or me or Noam Chomsky or Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. That's John Conyers, 30 years in the U.S. Congress. It's all very consistent with the campaign warnings of a liberal named John Edwards, who said, and I remember this because I was from Iowa and watched the caucus campaign very closely, he said repeatedly, and I heard him say it in person, that it was a complete fantasy to think that meaningful progressive reform could have been achieved by sitting down at a big negotiating table with big corporations and Republicans. Only an epic fight with corporate power, Edwards said, could achieve such reform. Edwards said that at a debate in Des Moines, and Obama's response is what Mike Davis calls typical eloquent evasion. He said, we don't need more heat, we need more light. That's Goldman Sachs talking. That's not true progressivism talking. There's something of a liberal left Nation magazine, Katrina Vanden Heuvel, Laura Flanders, Huffington Post myth, that all this surrender to corporate and financial power is contrary to Obama's deeper, genuine nature as a true left-leaning progressive, former community organizer, Southside legislator. Oh my God, you should have seen me add the campaign ads in Iowa. You never thought he ever went to corporate law, to Harvard Law, or anything like that. All he ever was community organizer. The former community organizer, the line goes, is just can't wait for the forces of popular democracy to rise up and make him do the really progressive things he really wants to do. Ms. Vanden Heuvel and John Nichols might want to look at my book for a very different and very detailed take on Obama's early history in Chicago, Springfield, and the U.S. Senate. They might want to look back at Ken Silverstein's 2006 article in Harper's, where a Washington lobbyist he spoke with says to him, the obvious, big donors, quote, would not be helping Obama out if they didn't see him as a corporate player. Lobbyist added, what's the dollar value of a starry eye of ideas? We wouldn't be pouring millions of dollars into a future president if we thought he was a left reformer. Every stage of his career, liberal journalist, liberal, not leftist at Z Magazine like me, Ryan Lizza noted about Obama last year, every stage has been marked by an eagerness to accommodate himself to existing institutions. In a carefully researched portrait of Obama based on extensive interviews, Larissa McFarquhar, also in the New Yorker, like Lizza, found that Obama was about as far from being a radical reformer as one could imagine in his view of history, in his respect for tradition, in his skepticism that the world can be changed any way, but very, very slowly. Obama, McFarquhar noted, in the New Yorker, not in Z Magazine or Monthly Review, is deeply conservative. That's a quote from her after in-depth interviews. It's not just that he thinks revolutions are unlikely. He values, she said, continuity and stability for their own sake, sometimes more than he values change for the good. Take healthcare, for example. McFarquhar noted, quoting Obama, how the United States for-profit health insurance companies were too deeply entrenched for us to evict them from their mafia-like control over our health care future. McFarquhar's portrait was consistent with how the left black political scientist Adolf Reed described the 30-something Obama in early 96, just after Obama won his first election to the Illinois legislature. Obama struck Reed as, quote, a smooth Harvard lawyer with vacuous to repressive neoliberal politics, including a fundamentally bootstrapped line, vapid talk about meeting in kitchens and small-scale solutions to social problems and the elevation of process over program, it struck Reed as the point where identity politics converges with old-fashioned middle-class reform in favor in form over substance. I am aware of a standard liberal defense that Obama is doing all he can for progressive values under the existing system of business and imperial power, corporate Washington. The argument goes, and I agree, leaves little room for progressive maneuver. Yes, that's true, but leaving aside the fact that the deeply conservative Larissa McFarquhar's description in 07, Obama goes farther, often goes farther than required to appease corporate and military masters. There's an obvious response to this defense, and that is this. Hey, maybe it isn't about running for president. Maybe it isn't about climbing to the top of this authoritarian system and helping that system rebrand and re-legitimize itself as, quote unquote, a democracy where, quote, anything is possible, as Obama said in his election night speech in downtown Chicago. No, maybe it's about, as Reed says, as Howard Zinn says, as Chomsky says, as Charles Durger says, and maybe it's about rebuilding and expanding social movements, creating a more responsive political culture beneath and beyond these big, quadrennial, business-coordinated, corporate, crafted, mass-marketed, narrow-spectrum, candidate-centered, candidate-obsessed, electoral extravaganzas, no Chomsky's phrase, the last one, that the power elite and its dominant media stage for us every 4 years and then ask us to go back to sleep. I think Reed got it right at the beginning, and as the brilliant black left Obama critic Glenn Ford recently put it in regard to Obama's predictable conservative trajectory as president, what begins badly usually ends badly. With all due respect for John Conyers, we might also heed the words of the Tarnak Nine, who wrote the following in their 2000 pamphlet, The Coming Insurrection. To be disappointed, one must have hoped for something. And we never hoped for anything from business. We see it for what it is and what it has always been, a fool's game of varying degrees of comfort. That's pretty much how I felt about the business liberal Barack Obama, and I might add about, generally speaking, the broader U.S. political system. But how I felt about Obama since he first leaped on the national stage in the summer of 04. It's no small part of why I actually picked him, contrary, John, to use the title Improbable Quest. I picked Obama as the next president in the fall of 06, in part because of all this stuff. John, I am finishing up. I hope you didn't get pumped by Barack Obama, your former professor at the University of Chicago. I do look forward to your comments.
That was Paul Street. Now we'll hear from John K. Wilson.
Thank you, Paul, for that. I don't believe that I've been pumped. In fact, I think the one thing we share is that in many ways, Barack Obama has been the kind of president that each of us expected him to be, and both of us expected him to win and be a president like he is. I think the larger question is how you define progressivism, how you define Obama within the progressive movement. And I know this is, my stand is in some ways an unpopular stand at the moment when Obama's poll ratings have reached an all-time low, and what I suspect may in fact be an all-time low of his presidency, and where the liberals and the progressives have started to turn upon Obama with a vengeance in many ways. And Obama himself talked about how people were getting all wee-weed up, and the reality is that they're not only getting all wee-weed up, they're also pissing on Obama, and sometimes for very good reason. That, as I noted in my book, that many of the left-wing critiques of Obama are well-deserved and on target. He's an imperfect politician in a corrupt political system. And so I don't want to present a naive, rose-colored glasses viewpoint of Obama or his presidency. It's absolutely true that he has not been everything he could be. He has not pursued all of the progressive policies that he could. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize what kind of progressive Obama is and where he stands within the progressive movement. And we also have to talk about what the progressive movement is. And in my view, it's very much a kind of big tent that has to include a wide range of different approaches to the progressive movement, precisely because I think that progressive ideas are a majority force in the country. They're obviously not a majority force within our political system and media, but I believe in general progressive policies represent the views of the majority. And as a result, if you believe that like I do, you have to understand that there's going to be a wide range of different kinds of progressives. And I think Obama was and is a real progressive, someone for, as is often cited in defense of his progressive values, someone who strongly spoke out against the war in Iraq, even though he's someone planning to run for the US Senate, someone who has embraced progressive values and progressive policies throughout his career. But he's not a progressive in the mold of Dennis Kucinich or Paul Wellstone or Bernie Sanders. He's not someone who's going to fight the good fight against all odds, someone who's going to speak truth to power, no matter how unpopular that stand is with the media or the politicians or the lobbyists. He's a very much different kind of progressive. And one of my books used a phrase in the subtitle, pragmatic progressive. And for me, that really is the embodiment of what Obama is, someone who has progressive values, but is always willing to engage in political compromise to get the legislation that's going to pass. And that's why I think we need a Big Ten progressive movement, one that has the Paul Streets and the John Wilsons, one that has the Bernies and the Barack's, that is capable of having people who are critiquing somebody like Obama as president, while still having the understanding that Obama really is a progressive president. And the right-wingers who complain that Obama is the most far-left president in our history are, in my view, correct. Unfortunately, that's not saying very much. But it is saying something that's actually really important. And the potential of Obama is not the kind of exaggerated expectations that I think some of the left had, that he was going to be our great progressive savior, that he would swoop down in the White House and sprinkle magic Obama dust everywhere, and suddenly everything that was bad about the Bush administration and that went wrong would be magically cured. That's not, first of all, that's not who Obama is, and secondly, that's not the power that a president really has in our political system. What Obama is somebody who changes the fundamental nature, I think, of the way the progressive movement can react and act in this country. And Paul talked a lot about rebuilding social movements, which is something I think is very essential. One of the reasons why the progressive movement in some ways died on the vine during the Bush administration and really in some sense gave up on dissent, with the exception of a small patriotic few, was precisely because George Bush and the presidency bred hopelessness. That, you know, what was the point of protesting against a war when George Bush would never listen to you? What was the point in pursuing all this other progressive policies and legislations if they weren't going to get through Congress as it stood and Bush would just veto them? And in many ways, I think a lot of what happened with the progressive movement was a product of having someone so terrible in the presidency. The opportunity with Obama is really there for a progressive movement to be vital and effective, to push Obama to the left, that is to the center in some ways, to the left of where he is now, and to push the rest of our political system. And Obama, in other words, is not the solution to all of the problems of the progressive movement and all the problems of the country. He's by far away not a solution to all of those problems. But he's not the person in general standing in the way. He's not the person getting in the way of that. He's someone who is really leading a lot of progressive legislation, but who can't do it by himself. And I think we saw a lot of this on the healthcare debate, where Obama was criticized on the left for ignoring single payer, for having this corporatist healthcare reform. But it's really Obama who's been the leader of what little progressive reform there is on healthcare being debated in this nation. That he's someone who expressed sympathy and support for the idea of single payer, but felt it wasn't politically possible. He's someone who's been pushing very hard for the public option, and the barrier to having healthcare reform with a public option has most certainly not been Obama. It's been the corporatist blue dog Democrats. It's Obama who's been fighting this virtually by himself. That in some ways you didn't see a progressive movement even really speaking out on the public option until the Obama administration started to hint, well, maybe we're not going to have a public option. And that's what really finally provoked the first signs that there's a progressive movement in this country in some ways in the last year. It's as if the progressive movement somehow decided that Obama was going to do all this for us and we didn't really need to do anything. And that was fundamentally not what the Obama campaign was about, and fundamentally not what it has to be about. It has to be about something much different than that, about building a movement that that's distinct from what Obama is, that is distinct from the campaign for Obama, that is a real movement. Now, having this kind of progressive big tent, to me, means that you have to accept the fact that I think Paul's idea of what a progressive is could never be elected president under the current system we have in this country. Someone like that would simply be impossible to get elected. They wouldn't be able to get through the media circus or through the political structure that we have. Obama, in that sense, may not be the ideal progressive at all. He may, in some ways, not be much of a progressive, but he's the only progressive president we've got or are ever likely to have in the foreseeable future. And what we need to do is understand what kind of progressive he is, understand what kind of progressive movement needs to be built to support him and also challenge him. And that's why Obama needs to be challenged from the West, but more importantly, Congress and the media need to be challenged from the left. So what we have in this country, in this progressive movement, is a case where we're always going to be disappointed by the political stars who have to live in the world of practical politics and the kind of corruption and the corrupt system we're under, and who often imagine, sometimes wrongly, that they need to compromise progressive values in order to get things done. But the fault, dear progressives, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we don't build this progressive movement that can really effectively bring about that change.
That was John K. Wilson. Paul Street comments widely online, including on the website of ZNet at www.zcommunications.org. John K. Wilson blogs online at obamapolitics.com. To learn more about the Open University of the Left, go online to www.openuniversityoftheleft.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.